Good morning, happy Sunday, and welcome to On the Weekend Edition. I am your host, Brian Pettaway. Thank you for listening in. And, you know, this is the last weekend of the month of May, which means it's also the last weekend of Mental Health Awareness Month. That being the case, I wanted to talk about kids because the Surgeon General just came out recently with a statement and a report stating that our kids are stressed, anxious, and depressed. And it's become a crisis in this country with our youth. And I wanted to find out why that would be. It seems today that kids have it easier than they've ever had it. I know when I was a kid, life was simple, but life was simple with chores. It was simple with respect for my elders. You know, I didn't have anyone that could just chauffeur me around from place to place. I didn't have this thing called Cash App where if I didn't have any money, I could have my parents send me some. If I didn't have money, I just couldn't do the thing. You know what I'm saying? Now it just seems like things are a lot easier for kids. But what I know is kids have a lot more access to things that I didn't have access to as well. And most of the things that they have access to that I didn't have access to was because I wasn't supposed to have access to these things. I wasn't an adult. Well, now with the advent of the internet, kids have much more access to adult things. Things that they should not be exposed to. And, you know, when your young mind has not matured enough to understand what you're seeing, it can cause confusion, sometimes fear, but oftentimes stress. And so I want to tackle that today when we speak to Dr. Baldwin, specifically about children and how she manages these children and their stress. But before we get to Dr. Baldwin, there are a couple things I want to mention that have happened in this world. And you know, this time last week, I was saying the same thing about another icon of ours, another black icon of ours, Jim Brown, the great football player who passed away at the age of 87. This week that just passed, we lost another icon, another wonderful, strong black icon in Tina Turner. She passed away at the age of 83. Now, I'm getting to an age now where not only are the people that I grew up watching on TV passing away, but my friends are starting to pass away. Since 2021, I've had so many friends or family members pass away, and I've gone to so many funerals that I got to a point where I just couldn't do it anymore. I can't go to another funeral. It feels like it's sucking the life out of me. And then I start to ask myself, are more people dying than used to? Like, are we dying earlier? And I know it sounds crazy. It doesn't make any sense. But it just feels like death is all around me, all the time. And so I wonder if you just get to an age, you just get to a point in your life where that's expected. Like, is that a natural thing? I don't know. I've never been this age before. So I'm trying to balance that out with, is it natural? Is it not natural to feel this way? So I need you guys to help me out. If you're 50 plus, hit me up on IG at On with Brian Pettaway. Let me know if you're feeling like I'm describing, if you don't feel it at all. And if you do feel this way, at what point did you start feeling this way? All right, let me sneak in a little local news before we get to the good doctor here. A lot of us know that there is a curfew that's going on in Baltimore. And according to Fox 45, the juvenile curfew is officially in full effect. Now, the policy, according to Mayor Brandon Scott, will have limited interaction between Baltimore police and juveniles. It involves transporting juveniles who are still out past curfew to what's being called connection centers. The article doesn't tell who's transporting these juveniles to connection centers. It just says that they are non-law enforcement personnel. Mayor Scott says that Baltimore police will have no other interactions with juveniles other than making a vacate announcement after hours. Now, as you might imagine, several Baltimore City Council members pushed back on the idea of no enforcement from law enforcement. And Baltimore Police Commissioner Michael Harrison says a curfew in itself does not warrant his officers for searching for weapons. However, law enforcement analyst Melissa Pinkleton has a different interpretation of enforcing a curfew. She says, if this is not a police matter, then how come all of the juvenile carjackings and shootings and riots have been police matters? You know, it seems like every time I want to get on the mayor's side, he comes up with this ridiculous thing. He imposes a curfew, right? But he doesn't set a standard for it. So who's going to monitor, who's going to enforce the curfew? If law enforcement's not going to be there to say, hey, you can't be on these streets, and there be a penalty or a fine for it, what's the point of having the curfew? If after the curfew, you're not subject to pat-downs to make sure that you don't have weapons, what is the point of having a curfew? I don't understand. It's almost as if Brandon Scott has decided he's just going to make it appear that he's trying to make a difference. Like, okay, I'm going to impose this curfew, but nobody's going to enforce it. There's going to be no penalties or fines for it. And if we see juveniles on the streets after the curfew hours, we're not going to pat them down. We're not going to ask them where they're going. We're not going to check for weapons. None of that stuff. We're just going to leave them alone. We don't want to harass them. Like, who are we making safe in that situation? I mean, I really want to know. What is the point of the curfew if that is in fact the case? It's like Brandon Scott has become the master of straddling the fence on everything without making a decision about anything, right? I mean, it's very interesting to me, this young mayor. And you know, I can imagine that governing this city is extremely difficult, even for the most seasoned politician. But you make it worse when you don't put your foot down and are not making concrete decisions on anything. That makes it worse. When your policies are so flighty and up in the air, it makes you look weak, is what happens. And it emboldens those who don't want to do the right thing, knowing that you're not going to do anything to them. So it's just a very, very unfortunate situation where I believe you have a good man who's doing a poor job because he's overwhelmed. And unfortunately, the lack of strong, concrete decisions as it pertains to the youth in the city, it makes the residents of this city a lot less safe. And that is the most unfortunate part. Okay, let's talk about the national front. The House and the Senate are out this weekend, and the president is spending this Memorial weekend at Camp David. So a deadline for the potentially catastrophic default was pushed back to June 5th, which likely means that the White House and Republicans are going to have another ugly week of negotiating. In addition to missing payments to veterans, military personnel, Social Security recipients, Medicaid beneficiaries, and more, a default is expected to spark panic on Wall Street. On Friday, UBS Wealth Management updated its outlook to reflect a scenario in which the S&P 500 could quickly drop by more than 10%. Wall Street being affected is really the saving grace here, because Wall Street does not discriminate, meaning those persons in Congress are heavily invested in Wall Street personally. And when those values drop, they lose a lot of money. They're not going to let that happen, because at the end of the day, greed is what keeps these people in office. It's not policies or wanting to help their constituents. It's greed. And so they're not going to allow for Wall Street to suffer. It's not Social Security or the VA that they care about, even though those dollars are paid in full from payroll taxes already. It's Wall Street and what they will lose personally if they allow this to happen. I mean, there'll be a lot of bloviation throughout the week, a lot of bloviation. It'll probably last until Thursday. And then on Friday, before the clock strikes 12, they'll sign a deal. And then we're supposed to be grateful and think they're so wonderful for coming together to sign this deal, when at the end of the day, what they're really concerned about is their own pockets. So every 4 years we go through this, and every 4 years I'm not concerned about the debt ceiling or defaulting on it, because I know that they're not going to let it happen. So I don't stress about it. It's a show. It's a show. Okay, now we do have people that are stressing in this country every single day, and it is unfortunately our youth. And I do have someone here to speak about that, and she has graced us with her presence and her knowledge before, and she is back again to talk about really what is her specialty, and that's talking about children. So without further ado, please help me welcome back to 1500 Radio, Dr. Carolyn Yvette Baldwin. All right, Dr. Baldwin, thank you so much for coming back and gracing us with all of your knowledge. How are you feeling today?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you so much for you and your audience having me back.
Absolutely. You know, the last time you were here, I asked people to send me questions, right, about what they would ask you if they were in my shoes talking to you. We didn't dive a whole lot into what your specialty was, which is dealing with students, dealing with children in the school system, because that's basically where you are most of the time, right?
That is true.
Well, with the Surgeon General coming out recently with his finding that the internet it's a crisis for our young people, I kind of just wanted to run down some things and ask you some questions that my listeners were interested in when it comes to the kids. And right off the break, and I hate to do this to you, but the most popular question, and it could be that I had a transgender young woman on last month who was very upfront about her, you know, how she lived and how she grew up feeling like she was trapped in another body. And she was very candid. Well, a lot of parents wanted to know how the school is dealing with or working with kids that are having concerns about their identity. Are you finding it difficult for children or teachers to deal with it more, or has it become a problem at all?
That's an interesting question. I don't think that it is a problem in the sense that my experience has been that the school system treats everyone equal. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's not a, the whole idea is to keep children safe. So if a student, no matter who they are, feels that they want to be identified by another gender or pronoun or name or whatever, the whole idea is to keep that child safe. So it's not a problem in the sense of we need to change a child. It's, does that child feel safe, and what is the best way to keep that child safe? The school system actually supports that. There are definitely guidelines within the school system, that have been developed for that very reason, to help students to feel safe within it. Still an ongoing conversation. It's always a conversation.
Right.
One of the biggest parts of the keeping them safe is really understanding the biases and the different kinds of things that students might be encountered with if they, if they come forth and say, I would like to be identified by a certain gender, by a certain name, by a certain pronoun. It's not frowned upon. It's not looked differently upon. It's just looked at and actually just acknowledged, and everyone tries to make that student feel safe.
Okay. The other question in regard to that is,
mm-hmm.
Do you believe that it is a peer pressure thing, it is a phase or fad, or do you believe it's something that is, you know, here to stay?
I have no idea. And I don't know if I actually approach it like that.
Okay.
If students come to, as a psychologist, if students come to my office and they have some level of concern, okay, it could be fear, it could be trying to understand, it could be confusion. My job is not to judge. My
right.
job is to help you to clarify how you are feeling, clarify what obstacles might be coming, your way. How can we problem solve through it? What kind of supports do you need? Do you need counseling? Do you just need a safe space to exist? It's not about outing a student. It's not about, bringing any kind of outside forces in. It is strictly to make a student safe. And most schools have, between the counselor, the social worker, the pupil personnel, or I work in a specific county, pupil personnel worker, the psychologist, their wellness centers. So there are all kinds of places that students can go to get support. So it's never a question of, is there someone available for you to talk to? The question is, who do you feel most comfortable talking to?
Right. Okay.
And what is the concern that we're talking about? Very rarely, when students come in with a concern around gender, is it really about the gender? It might be around the anxiety. And so then the question becomes, how can we peel that apart and see what is it about it that is troubling you? I do think that it is, it's an ongoing thing, and it's across the board, and every district handles it differently, but I don't think any district is handling it in a negative or an adverse way.
Okay.
Because, again, the objective is to keep the student safe.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, that sounds fair. I appreciate that. The other question that was at the top of the list was in regards to, as you can imagine, bullying. Do you think bullying has become worse, or do you think it's gotten better? There's so much more awareness about bullying than there was when I was a kid. But has the internet made it worse?
I think the internet is its own culprit. What do I mean by that? The internet is so accessible to students. They have so much access to social media platforms than I think we did when we were younger. But It's about how much they allow themselves to be involved and have that access to it. During the school day, they have limitations. So even though they might have Chromebooks and that kind of thing, most school districts will restrict their ability to really kind of access. And if they are found to have violated that, then, you know, there are precautions that they can put on their Chromebook. A lot of times what I am seeing is that when students are engaged in a lot of social media, it is usually outside of the school building.
Okay.
And then it makes its way back into the school building. To answer your question about bullying, I think bullying changes its face depending on how you want to it changes depending on where you are, right? It could be cyberbullying. It could be cyberbullying is really big. And so what happens is people hide behind those social media platforms.
Right.
And so a lot of times students don't really know who they're talking to, and they don't know who's engaged in it. And so you kind of get that syndrome that happens with the social media piece. But bullying then can also present its face within a school building. So after something might happen on the cyber platform, then it might make its way into an actual physical building.
Right.
And then it might blow up in a whole different kind of way, because now you have different players involved.
Okay. I see it often, how kids are affected by the cyberbullying. And it just mm-hmm. seems that it's become so much more intense than it
yes.
used to be. And I think it's yes. because, like you say, cyberbullying penetrates the home. It used to be if you made it to your porch, you were safe. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But now mm-hmm. It penetrates the house, and you're just not safe from it.
And it goes across, not just within your house. I've heard parents and students talk about gaming, and they might be gaming with someone in another country. They might
right.
be in another state. They might be, you know, so you have no idea of who and how that is playing itself out. When you're on the internet, you just don't know. You think you're talking to one person, or you think you're talking to one individual, and you have no idea you might be on with three or four different people.
Right.
So I
right.
think, you know, the cyberbullying and the social media platforms take on a life of their own.
Well, the surgeon,
they can definitely be detrimental.
Absolutely. Well, the Surgeon General just came out this week or weekend
mm-hmm.
with a statement that the internet and social media is now harmful to all children, to the point where it's a crisis. And I didn't know if you could just maybe explain what he meant by that.
Without reading the article, the one thing that comes to mind is that I know that there have been some suicides that have happened because of some cyberbullying,
okay.
because of some things that have happened, on those type of platforms that you really have difficulty controlling, particularly in the middle of the night or something like that. I do recall reading about, you know, some students that literally have lost their lives or taken their lives.
Right.
So I think that might be where that is. But without reading the article, it's really difficult for me to actually address what that, you know, person was intending for it. But that would be my first thought behind it. A lot of students who don't really have those social connections and really kind of struggle with integrating with their peers, a lot of times they find friendships and they find a way to engage on those social media platforms. And those are the students I think that you have to really be careful about, because they tend to have a higher level for anxiety. They have a higher level for depression or just isolation. And anytime you can pull anyone into an isolated space, it leaves them more vulnerable.
Exactly right. No, that you're exactly right. I think a lot of the article was approaching how kids, they stay on their electronic devices even after they're supposed to be asleep. So it affects mm-hmm. their sleep patterns. They don't
yes.
eat properly because they're rushing to eat, or they're eating halfway because they're at the dinner table, you know, with their phones mm-hmm. in their hands. You know, you see kids fighting teachers on Reels and TikToks, just trying to get their phone back because this was taken from them by their teacher because they're in the classroom looking at, you know, Facebook, whatever. So it's gotten to a point, I think, where the concern is how do we regulate, and I'm going to ask you this question, what's the best way to regulate kids in reference to having their social media available to them?
If I had the answer to that, I could pretty much just retire and quit my job and just go and just write about that and do that. I have no idea the answer to that question. And the reason that I don't have the clear reason that I don't have an answer to that is because it's all subjective, right? Students have access to so many different forms of technology,
right?
And so they can reach social media through all kinds of platforms, and sometimes they don't even need a full-fledged, you know, laptop or a desktop in order to do it. They can access through their phones, and so, you know, a lot of times I hear students or parents saying, well, they need their phone because I need to be able to get in touch with them,
right?
So I have no idea. I think monitoring the sites and the places that they are is probably the one thing that parents can do. And I think the other thing is that if you have a good relationship with your child, then you can have conversations. And I think you can have what I call courageous conversations about the safety of what they're doing.
Right.
I recall in one of the schools that I worked in, this was a few years ago, we did have a police officer that year to come in, and whatever his detail was, he specifically dealt with the cyber world, and he did it with the staff because it was in one of our in-services. He gave us an insight into what happens behind some of those sites and some of the things that are the predatory things that happen behind some of those sites. It's very enlightening. I would have to look up and I will see if I can find you that information to kind of share with your listeners. But I mean, I think just having courageous conversations with students about, you know, this is really the kind of thing that's happening. And this, you know, it doesn't mean that it's happening on every platform, but these are the kinds of things that you have to be aware of. You just have to be mindful of.
Right. Right. It's very true. Conversation is always good. I had a deep conversation with my teenage daughter this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But before I tell you about that, I want to ask you a question. And that is, it seems that violence and anger with kids, or their anger is acted out more with violence, mm-hmm, in schools than ever before. At least we're seeing it more. We're seeing kids, mm-hmm, attack teachers, mm-hmm, more. We're seeing kids attack each other more. Kids are getting shot in the schools. They're getting shot in the parking lots of the school, on the way home from school. Even had a kid shoot another kid on the bus. What's going on? Are there any programs within the schools with counselors that can recognize kids with these issues before these kinds of things happen? You know what I mean? Like, you just don't want to take kids with anger issues and throw them out of school, right? Is there anything that counselors or the school board is doing to try and recognize these issues before they arise?
I think that's a loaded question, and I think that there are about three different parts to that question, so let me peel it apart a little bit. Okay. I'm going to back into it. So are there things that the school system does to help with coping strategies and coping skills and help students that have behavioral or anger management or things like that? Let's talk about that piece first. Yes. As I mentioned something earlier, particularly in the district that I'm in, there are wellness centers that are attached to hospitals. The wellness centers, for example, that are in our schools are not, they're housed in the school, but they're not school employees. They are literally clinical staff.
Okay.
So it's almost like the mediator. They're our direct contact into getting into a clinical setting if a student needs to get there. Within the schools, you have counselors, you have psychologists, you have social workers, you have pupil personnel workers, you have administration, you have crisis center, you have all of these different resources. There's local community councils. There are all kinds of resources within a school setting that can be tapped into. So to answer the back part of the question of what is the school systems doing, the school systems are definitely putting things in place because they recognize that social-emotional health for students is important.
Okay.
So those kinds of things are definitely in place. Now let me move into a different layer.
Okay.
In terms of the types of behaviors that are showing up, I think they've always been there. They are more visible now based on things that we just talked about, social media. They have access to seeing so much more. They have so much more information coming in that what you view is kind of how you kind of, you know, watch things. They've got games. They've got gaming. They've got TikToks. They've got videos. They've got people from other countries. They've got people from other places. They've got all kinds of information feeding them. And that can influence and that can color what they do and how they do it. And so if you add all of those pieces up together, now you have a student that has so much access to so much information that they just have to figure out what to do with the information. And a lot of them act on it or try to mimic it or try to figure out if it's something that, you know, how far that can they walk that boundary line? Can
right.
they move that needle a little bit further? I wonder what would happen if I did that here. I think those kinds of things start happening. But I think it's always been there. And I say that because I remember I did my dissertation like a bunch of years ago.
Okay.
But what I looked at was the effects of violence and post-traumatic stress on children's ability to achieve. That was back in 99, okay? And school shootings and that kind of thing were things that I researched. So this kind of thing it has been there. It has been happening. The other thing is that things are happening on so many other levels that are not in your public school environment that are also coloring. The Virginia Tech shootings, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
you've got college campuses now that are being impacted even more so than before. You have work environments that are being impacted more than before. So all of those things from not just social media, but from the news that you're seeing. So there's a boatload of more information that's being filtered into kids and they have access to that is definitely coloring what happens with them. And it's a matter of if they will choose to use the resources in their buildings. Because the resources won't necessarily come to them, but if they're identified, we can come get them. But they have to be willing souls to come in.
Okay. I was in high school in the 80s, right?
Okay.
And I don't ever remember, like ever remember seeing throughout my entire academic career, I don't ever remember seeing a student hit a teacher or even square up on a teacher like they wanted to. Like that was just like way crossing the line, right? There were so many consequences that you faced if you even attempted to do that. But now it just seems like, and maybe it's me, maybe I'm just older and I'm an old guy, but now it seems like kids just don't, they're just not afraid of those consequences. They just seem to be so far more emboldened than I ever was or any of my peers ever were as kids. So that's why I was asking about, is the anger amped up? Like, is there something going on with our kids where they're angrier? You know what I mean? It's just
the
behavior's different.
So it's hard to say, and I didn't mean to cut you off. It's hard to say if they're angrier because I'm not sure that we can compare our time of growing up to their time of growing up, right? But I do think that the understanding of trauma-informed care and the acts of trauma and the acts of violence and the acts of racial hatred and biases and hate crimes and like those kinds of things have risen to the top and are more visible. So I think that impacts what happens with kids. They have more, I go back to the exposure. There's so much more exposure that's going on right now than we ever had. I think about even like my grandparents, it's not that they didn't have those same kinds of things to deal with, but it was on a different level and their exposure to it wasn't the same.
It just seems the respect level is a lot lower and the bar for having respect is a lot lower. You know what I mean?
That's probably true. Yeah, that can also be, I'm going to say that can also be subjective, because I know some teachers and I know some students that would never occur with. Like, I know I have seen some teachers that they never even think about. Like, that would not be the person that they would go to.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But at the same time, and it's not that teacher has squared up or has threatened them or has done anything. It's what you just, the word that you just used, is the respect for that teacher. And it's the respect for that person that they're like, nah, that's not the person, right?
Right.
But I don't really know. I don't know where the breakdown happens.
Okay. That's fair. You mentioned racial tension.
Mm-hmm.
One of the questions that was posed is in regards to CRT. It's just been such a big thing in schools. It's been such mm-hmm. a big topic in different states. Who's going to allow it? Who's not? And it's always been based on whether teaching kids about the stain of this country, enslavement, Jim Crow, if that would make white kids feel guilty, give them a guilt complex, or make black kids have an inferiority complex. Do you believe either one of those to be true? Is it something that you believe should be taken out, or you think it's something that, you know, you should teach the history as it actually is, regardless of, I mean, truth is truth. I mean, how do you feel about it?
Well, okay.
I didn't mean to ambush you.
No. I think that you should teach the truth. I think you should teach what history is. It is history. You should teach it. History is not always pretty.
Right.
It's ugly. Even if we move from black history, white history, American history, if you look at the history in your families, it's not all pretty.
Right.
But it's the history that makes us who we are. And I think when you fail to teach history and when you fail to teach people the whole truth and nothing but the truth, then you get fragmented people. And you get people who really need to understand, like they lose a piece of themselves. So I am under the understanding, or for myself at least, I believe that you should teach kids the whole history, all of the history. It's not going to be pretty, but you should teach it because they deserve to know it. To answer the question, there's not a load of questions today. To answer the question of if black history will harm students, white students, I don't know. And I have to answer that honestly because I'm not a Caucasian. I'm not white. I am an African American woman, and I don't know. And I don't know what that does, right? I know that not knowing my history, how that has impacted me over the years. And when I start hearing different components, fortunately, I grew up with learning a lot of my own history.
Right.
I grew up learning African-American history and black history. I can't say that I necessarily learned it in the school, but I did learn it. I learned some in the school, but I learned mostly at home. And I learned in the church, and I learned from, because I'm a reader. But I do think, and I believe that you should tell the whole truth. You should definitely teach kids the whole thing. And whatever the fallout is, then you have to go back and you have to address it. You have to address whatever the fallout is, because if someone is offended by something, one has to ask the question, why does that offend you? What is it about that offends you? Why is that a place of offense? What nerve did that touch for you?
Right. An offense, an offensive, that's the key word in this whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
the concern is that white children will be offended by what they are hearing. And as soon as they hear a word or a topic that offends them, then the teachers have to stop the conversation. And I'm just trying to figure out.
If you ask the other side of that question, so one side of that question would be, are white kids going to be offended by black history? The question on the other side is, are black kids going to be offended if you don't teach that history?
Hmm.
Yeah, the antithesis of that is just that. So if you don't teach it, will the black kids be offended? And do you care as much about them as you do about the white kids being offended? So now we're talking about equal, and we're talking about, you know, because we go into, now we start talking about biases.
Right.
And at some point, I think we all have to examine what our own biases are. Okay. How have we all been indoctrinated? How have we all been taught? What does that mean to you? How important is that to you?
That's a good point. That's a very good point. But you don't have people coming into your office, kids, with these concerns, I would assume.
Well, coming in with what concerns?
The concerns about the racial makeup or of the curriculum or racial bullying or any of those kinds of things.
So those that's back to the loaded question.
Right.
so again, I'm going to peel it apart. I don't teach in the classroom. So anything about classroom history, studying, academics, no, I don't get. But what I do get and what does come to all of us within the buildings, and not just my building, but in all the buildings, what does come up is hate crimes, racial biases, how students feel, how comfortable students feel, black and white, how comfortable students feel. You know, you have black, you have Asian, you have LGBTQ, you have transgender, you have like all of the women, like all of it. It all shows up because there are people involved. Right. And when you have people involved, and it doesn't matter the age of the person, when you have people involved, then you have people issues that come up. And so do they come directly to me? Maybe not directly to me, but eventually they might come to me. They might come from a parent. They might come from an administrator. They might come to a teacher, and the teacher might come. But I'm not directly in a classroom, so I don't hear it right off. I can tell you that there are definitely programs in the conversation about racial biases and hate crimes and those kinds of things are being talked about within the schools. They are definitely there are conversations that are happening.
Okay. All right. Well, okay.
They are active conversations good. That are being happening.
Good. That's good. The last thing I want to pick your brain about mm-hmm. is I had a mother on my show in September, mm-hmm. and she had lost her daughter. Her daughter had taken her life, and we were talking about suicide prevention because it was Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month, and she was telling me that a lot of the kids that we might think are suicidal in reference to, you know, the kids that are drugged out or the kids that are drinking a lot or skipping school. She says, you know, what you really have to be concerned about are the overachievers because those mm-hmm. are the ones that are stressing the most. And mm-hmm. she said her daughter was an overachiever. Now, I had a conversation with my little girl because her birthday was just on Saturday and I wanted to do all these great things with her, right? Mm-hmm. And she didn't want to do anything. I'm like, what are you talking about? She's like, well, Dad, you know, I had baseball season and, you know, I was in the play and I got the band and my exams are next week and I just don't really want to do anything, right? And I asked her, I said, what are you concerned about with your exams? And she said, well, I'm worried about how I'm going to do. And she says, don't worry about Spanish. I'm really good with Spanish. I said, so what is your most difficult subject where you have your lowest grade? And she said, language arts. And I said, okay, well, what is your grade in language arts? And she said, it's an A-. Now, to me, an A-, growing up, I wish I'd gotten an A-, most of my grades. But for her, it was a very stressful situation, right? Mm-hmm. She's really stressing it. And that scares me because you can't be perfect. And I had that conversation with her. I said, you know, doing your best is your best. I said, I don't want you stressing over an A-. I said, that's a phenomenal grade, you know. But I'm trying to figure out, like, where do kids get this from? Like, you know what I'm saying? And how concerned should parents like me be in situations like this?
Okay. I love this today. Today's conversation is full of loaded questions. I love it. Let's break this one apart. Okay. Let's go back to where you started. And my heart goes out to the parent who lost their child.
Yes.
And all the parents who lose their children or lose someone via suicide. It's horrific. So let me address that piece first as it relates to schools. There's a program that we implement. We do it yearly. It's called Signs of Suicide. And so we do suicide prevention training. So we try to get ahead of the problem, just trying to get people to be aware of the signs to look for students who are students or even whoever, signs of someone who is actually struggling, okay? So that program is actually implemented through the year. And there's a part in that conversation. It's done with the grade levels. And when at the end of that conversation, there is a place for a child to anonymously indicate that they need to talk to someone.
Okay.
It's not brought out in front. It's not like, hey, I'm going to raise my hand. I've thought about this. It's nothing like that. So there's an anonymous way for that to happen. So I do want to put that out there, that the school systems definitely do address the whole suicide prevention process. Okay. One of the things that I always share and we try to emphasize during that process is check on your strong friends.
Right.
Because the strong friends are the ones that are holding everything in, because they are wound tight, because they are overachievers. And usually if I'm in a process, or if I'm one of the co-teachers in one of those sessions, I'll always introduce myself and I go, hello, my name is Dr. Baldwin and I'm an overachiever.
Okay. All right.
So I understand overachieving. Like I got that part. Come talk to me. I know that part. I got that down. And I think that makes students feel comfortable, because they're like, okay, you know, and if they know someone can hear them, and that becomes the big thing. Students need to be heard, and not just students, but people, particularly someone that's grappling with that internal space, they just need to be heard. And a lot of times we don't hear the strong people. We don't hear the people who seem like they always have themselves together. We don't hear those people who we think are always on point. So my takeaway from that is always check on your strong friends. Don't just check on the one that you think is sitting over in the corner. The one that's quiet might be also the one that you need to talk to.
Right.
You're a straight A student. Go have a conversation with that person. So I wanted to kind of address that. I don't want to gloss over that. The other thing that you talked about were grades versus grades and expectation,
right,
versus whatever else is going on. I think that we're in a very competitive space right now academically, because there is a push for students to do so well, because there's scholarships, there's money, there's all of these high achieving careers that we want to advance ourselves to. And we always want to do well and we want to be patted on the back. But I think the expectation of students has to be realistic, and it has to be a conversation. And the conversation I would say have with your daughter is, okay, let's just map out what it is that you want to do. Not just what do you want to do academically, not what do you just want to do in your career. What fun things do you want to do?
Okay.
Like what are some of the like, okay, after you get that done, after you go and get the Nobel Peace Prize, after you go after you do that, where would you like to see yourself? Would you like to be on a beach? Would you like to be in Italy? Would you like to go to Germany? Would you like where would you like to go? And so I sometimes will have I've recently had a couple of kids in my office, and I said, let's do some vision boards. Let's talk about not just the achievements that you want to do. Let's talk about the places you want to go, because your achievements have to be directed somewhere.
Okay.
We have to make sure that we can give you another side to that story, because it doesn't make sense for you to get straight A's, get the Nobel Peace Prize, go be a Rhodes Scholar, go do all of these great things, and then you know, we got to go get you out the corner.
Right.
Like, we don't want
right.
that. I want you to go and achieve some other things. So let's talk about all of the things that we want you to do. So I think giving students a well-rounded perspective of everything that they can achieve, including some social pieces, mm-hmm. is very helpful. Because I think as we get older, we forget to dream.
Right, right. No, you're right.
As little kids, when they're young, they don't think as much about academics. They just want to be creative. They draw you a picture, and you are sitting there trying to figure out what is that, and they give you a whole story behind it.
Right,
And you're squinting your eye and looking to the left, like, oh, okay, that's a pool and a pony and everything. But as they get older, we stress to them, I need you to get that A. Your teacher's called. I need you to get that. And so it's like, let them dream a little bit.
Right.
Let them dream a little bit. So, and I'm not saying that that's with every situation, but I'm finding more of when I have I don't know if I said it in the last time I was on, I have a sign in my office that says, what would you do if you knew you could not fail?
Yeah, I have that t-shirt.
And that is the hardest question for people to answer. What would you do if you knew you could not fail?
Right.
And I have students all the time, like, kind of sit there, like, all my overachievers, and they start telling me, like, but if I hit, but I won't be able to get this. And I was like, no, that's not a part of the conversation. And then they have to rethink and have to come back into themselves and think about, oh, that's not a factor. I can do that. Yeah, you can do that. And so now they begin to start dreaming again. So I think we have to start dreaming more.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate you today. I mean, I really, really
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
I told you I was going to call you again. I told you.
This is true. You did tell me. And I appreciate every call. And if you call me again, I'll come back again.
Awesome.
I appreciate it. I think the thing that I would leave with in this conversation is particularly the questions that your listeners presented. There's more than one answer to the questions, and there's more than one layer to the questions. So I don't want them to walk away thinking that this is the only answer or this is the only conversation about it. I think there are layers to it, and I think you have to peel the layers back in order to really get to an answer that you may or may not agree with, you may or may not make sense, but sometimes you just got to walk away with just the understanding that, okay, there is an answer out there, so there's some place to start.
Right. Well, the start is with the conversation, and to have mm-hmm. someone on the show that is knowledgeable and helps keep the conversation going is basically what I wanted, so I appreciate you doing that for us. And
Absolutely.
The more conversations we have about it, and the more aware we are of the solutions to these problems, or creating solutions, the better it'll be for everyone. So I'm so thankful that you came on today.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, Dr. Baldwin, you take care of yourself now, and
you'll
be hearing from me again.
Thank you so much. Have a great one.
All right.
I'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye. Well, I know you hear the music. It is that time. It's time for the Petty. So let's give him a call and see what he's got for us today.
Good morning, Brother B. How are you?
It is the Petty. How you doing this morning, man? I'm great.
I'm just fantastic. Happy Memorial Day weekend to you, Brother B.
I appreciate it.
I know you're going to go out there and grab a burger or two or something.
Hey, I might be flipping
them. This is the weekend where they're going to be grilling, having a good time. But you know what you should be doing?
What's that?
You should be going down to the stadium and watching those high-flying O's play on Monday afternoon. But you know what? We're going to talk about them a little later.
Okay.
All of Baltimore should be chirping about those birds, because the birds are chirping and you should be talking about them. But you know what? We're going to start off. We're not going to talk about the state of Maryland. We're going to talk about what's going on in the state of Florida. I'm telling you, Brother B, there's some happenings going on down there. You got an NBA team that's getting ready to go to the finals. You have a Stanley Cup team that's getting ready to go, NHL team that's ready to go to the Stanley Cup finals. And now you have a baseball team that's down there that's red freaking hot.
Talking about the Rays?
I'm talking about the Rays are tearing it up, in not only in the American League, but in Major League Baseball. I'm talking about the Florida Panthers that are tearing it up in hockey. And, of course, I'm talking about the Heat. Florida has something to celebrate again.
Yeah.
Outside of being just the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It's hot down in Florida, and I'm not talking about the weather. I'm talking about those teams, too.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not a huge fan of Florida right now because of the governor, but it is what it is.
Well, the governor, like you said, it is what it is, but we're not talking about the governor. We're talking about those three hot teams.
Right,
and
right.
And Florida
right.
has something to celebrate.
What do you think about those Heat? What do you think about the Heat?
I think, you know what? I like what they're doing down there. I used to like the coach, but man, it's become like a little smug imitation of.
Right.
No, I'm talking about
Pat Riley.
He's starting to become a little smug imitation of Pat Riley.
Yes, he is.
So I liked him when he first got with the team. I liked when he took him to the championship the first time. But now it's like, you know what? I'm starting not to like him. But I like what they put together down there. I like that team. They really don't have a big superstar. I mean, Jimmy Butler is a star.
Yeah,
but, I mean, they don't have the big name. They're doing it as a unit. And that's what I like to see. I like teams come together and do it as a unit. And that's why I like the Heat.
Did you hear the rumors about Jimmy Butler possibly being Michael Jordan's illegitimate son?
Oh, come on. Cut it out.
I swear,
who's
bro.
Who's starting this stuff?
Where's this stuff
coming from?
I'm telling you. You can Google it. Yeah, they talk.
Okay,
about.
Well, you know what? There's some aliens in Roswell, Georgia that you might want to go check out. I'm going to check out down in Area 51. And you know what? If you really believe that stuff, there's some swamp land that I have to sell you down in Florida.
Okay.
Speaking of Florida.
Hey, man, I didn't make it up. I'm just telling you what I read.
Okay. Well, this is kind of like off the cuff and somewhere from just pulling it out the air, but I don't know how many people are interested, but the CFL starts their season. I'm talking about Canadian football.
Right.
Starts their season in just 13 days. And we're talking about these guys. And even though they're up north and the weather still gets warm up north, they will be starting to play their football season in 13 games.
You have always. Days. In fact, you introduced me to Canadian. You've always been a fan of Canadian football. You turned me on to Canadian football.
Well, you have to remember, that was several years ago when the NFL went on strike. They went on strike for a significant amount of time, and the Canadian Football League televised their games down here in the United States, and I became a big fan. It's a little different. You know, they only play three downs, and there have been some stars that have come down here and played in the NFL
right.
from Canadian League. One of the biggest stars, and I'm pretty sure everybody's heard this name, Warren Moon.
Yeah.
Won 5 Grey Cup championships up in the Canadian Football League before he came to the NFL.
Yeah. Doug Flutie went up there and then came back, too.
Doug Flutie went up there. Yeah. One of my favorites, Jeff Garcia.
Yeah.
Came to the 49ers from playing up in the CFL.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They start their season. If anybody's kind of want to check out a different style of football, because the field is longer, it's wider, and you're talking about there's a whole lot of passing going on.
Yeah,
they're only
is.
Playing the three downs. And it's really interesting. And some of the rules that the NFL now have come from some things that happened in the XFL, the USFL, and even the CFL.
Right. I'm glad I got you, man. I wanted to ask you about this new rule for punting, the new punting rule that's going to be in the NFL next year. And I don't know.
I was going to get to that, and you beat me to the punch.
Sorry,
I don't
man.
Like it. I don't like anything about the kickoff and the punting rules. I like the old. I'm an old school guy. I like to see some smash mouth football. I want to see somebody get slammed. Not making a fair catch and thinking that they can catch the ball and get away from the defender. That's what I want to see. I don't even want to see the fair catch. If you want to do away with a rule in the NFL, get rid of the fair catch.
Right.
That's what
right.
you get rid of. Bring back the standard kickoff. Bring back when you move it back to the 20-yard. I believe it used to be to the 20 or 25-yard
yeah,
line
yeah.
so that there are more run backs. I want to see real football. Football has gotten soft. I am still a big fan of the NFL. I'm still a big fan of any style of football. But the NFL is starting to get softer and softer.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you got your tough rules. You got your unnecessary roughness rules on the quarterback. Unnecessary roughness on the defenseless receiver. I want to see some old-style football where they're bringing the cart out and carting somebody off almost like every other play. That's what I want to see.
Right.
Football is a man's game. Let's see some real men play the game. I don't want to hear about turf toe and a hangnail. I want to hear about a broken arm or broken nose. Somebody going in there. I'm doing what a Ronnie Lott did. You know what? Cut my finger off. I want to get back in the game.
Right.
That's what I want to see.
Well, here's the question. Here's the question that I have for you. As players are getting bigger, stronger, and faster, like freakishly so, like supernaturally so, when you have 280-pound linemen running 4.4s and 4.5s, right? That's not natural to me.
But when you have that, don't you have to protect the players a little bit better? And if you're not protecting the players, right, is the equipment supposed to be better? I mean, do you have to trim some rules just because of the evolution of the of human beings?
You have to curve it just a little bit, but don't take it where it's not entertaining as it used to be. Listen, you want to take something away from football? Take away some of the PEDs. They have to worry about these big old linemen running faster than what they used to run, and you know these guys being super strong. You want to do that? Take that away. Right. That's what you did.
You think it's still PEDs that are doing it? Even though they screen and test for them as much
Brother
as they do?
Brother B, come on.
I'm just asking, man.
There's some PEDs in every sport.
Right.
Here's a good example. Now, I'm not a fan of football. I like baseball. I watched Barry Bonds. I remember when he was a Pittsburgh Pirate.
Right.
And I remember what he looked like when he was a Pittsburgh Pirate.
Right.
Now, I'm going to tell you something, Brother B. As we get older, yeah, we get a little pudgier. This dude... I mean, he didn't get pudgier. He got bigger.
Yeah, he got jacked.
He went to San Francisco.
Right.
So what was that? You tell me, Brother B, what was it?
I mean, it could become muscle maturity from him working. I mean, he could have changed his whole... I'm with you. I believe that he definitely did some PEDs. He was never found to have done it. He was never convicted of it, although he went to trial for it. But I do believe that he did ingest some PEDs. But but at that time, I don't believe that it was an advantage because the pitchers were also ingesting PEDs, right? So I think that he was just doing what everybody else was doing. And I don't excuse it, but it was great for baseball because everybody started watching it. When you had Sosa and McGuire and Bonds and all of these guys crushing the ball, and you had pitchers like Roger Clemens taking it. And, I mean, everybody was doing it.
So what makes you think that they're not doing it in the NFL?
Well, because they screen for it so much in the NFL. And they screen for it randomly, and they screen for it often. So I just don't know. And the penalties are so much more severe than they are in baseball. If you're set out for 16 games in a football league, you're done. You're done for that season. You can sit out 16 games in a baseball game and still run and still play for 80 games.
Brother B, I know you are not that naive to not think that there's ways of getting around these drug tests so that these players can get on the field. The fans want to see certain style of football. They want to see certain players. These players are playing, and there's ways of skirting around.
Right.
There's ways of skirting around all types of drug tests and searching for PEDs or any type of drug use. This guy needs to play, he's playing. And the report is, well, we screened him, he's clean. And we know he's just as dirty as they come.
Right. I just think that they screen harder for drugs and PEDs in the NFL because it is such a contact sport. And if anybody, like the kid Hamlin that was almost killed last year, right? If either one of those players, either he or the guy that hit him, I forget the safety's name that hit him, if either one of them had come up dirty after taking a drug test, the whole league would have gone down if he had passed away. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just think it's so much of a risk because of the contact of the sport, unlike baseball, that they screen a lot harder and a lot more often.
I'm not going to deny it. I'm not going to dispute it. I'm not going to, you know, argue that fact with you. I'm just saying that I think that football has gotten softer. Maybe it's the equipment that needs to get better. I mean, technology has moved so fast, and modern medicine has moved so fast. I'm pretty sure they can find some manufacturers that can find better equipment for football players.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm a strong advocate for finding better and safer equipment for football players, but just don't make the game soft.
Right. I agree with you. I agree with you 100% on that. Not to mention the All-Star game was a flag football. Come on, man. A flag football game? I didn't watch it either.
It's a farce. And that's what Andy Reid is saying. He's saying, you know, some rules are good for the game. Yes, there are some rules there to protect the players. He said, but we're starting to get to the point where we will be playing flag football pretty soon.
Right.
Andy Reid said this.
Right.
This
right.
is a guy that's going to be a future Hall of Fame coach, a two-time Super Bowl winning coach. And if he said it, then maybe it's something he needs to start thinking about. It's like, hey, maybe we are making it a little soft. Maybe we need to go back to some old smash mouth football.
I don't think they'll go back. I think the only way they'll go back is when the money starts hurting them. When people stop tuning in, stop going to games,
that's when they'll revert back. But that hasn't happened yet.
Well, Brother B, the NFL is a multi-billion-dollar machine, and them losing money is like us losing a dime or a quarter.
Right.
Well, they don't care. You know, they sign these big contracts where it's really hard to watch a game free anymore on TV. They're signing with Amazon. They're signing with Nickelodeon. They're signing with YouTube. They're signing with ESPN
right.
and all these cable networks and streaming networks. So now you have to pay. If you weren't paying to go to the game at the stadiums, you're paying to stay at home to watch it. So do you think they're worried about losing money? NFL's not worried about losing money because they're going to get it. And they're finding ways to make sure they keep their pockets lined.
Well, at the end of the day, my brother, the only way they get paid is if consumers watch the game. If consumers aren't watching the game, i.e. in the stands or even on TV, they lose billions of dollars because no TV network is going to pay if they're not getting ratings. It's just not going to happen. Ratings actually drive the money. And if they're not getting the ratings from people watching, they're not going to pay the NFL any money to cover them.
Well, I tell you what, Brother B, we're going to revisit this conversation, and we're going to look at what the ratings were for this upcoming season, and we're going to see how much money the NFL could possibly have lost if they didn't get the ratings that they did get.
Okay.
And we're going to compare some of those ratings to what their past ratings have been. And
okay.
I'm telling you, you're going to find out that they're making much more money than they have in the past.
Oh, I don't doubt
it. Now they're reaching out to the streaming outlets, and because people are still watching. I complained about what I got to pay X amount of dollars to watch it. What? But I've been doing it for the last 20 years.
Right.
And the price just keeps going up because I want to see certain games. I want to see the game.
Right.
And if there's guys like there out there like me, they're going to fork over that dollar and they're going to see it. So the NFL's not going to lose any money. But enough about that. I'm going to get back to the NFL. I'm going to talk about your team.
Okay.
But speaking of football, XFL, USFL, not too much reporting on, except for the XFL has sent 22 players to the NFL. 22 players from the XFL have signed contracts with NFL teams.
Wow.
A total of 67 have had tryouts.
Wow.
So it looks like the XFL is a place for players to go to enhance their skills and possibly get their contract from an NFL team.
That's like the G League of the NBA.
Yes, that's what it seems like. Not too much to talk about the USFL. I mean, I thought that the New Orleans Breakers were the team that's going to rise to the top, but now we're back to almost ground zero where they're all on even playing field. There's basically just one game separating the top team from the lowest team, and there's only a couple of weeks left in the USFL. So we're going to see how that plays out. But let's talk about some chirping birds. Let's talk about those high-flying Orioles. Yeah, they took it tough on the chin Friday night. I mean, boy, Texas came in here and gave them a good old Texas-style whooping. But the Orioles still remain the second-best team in the majors. I don't care who comes in to play. Those guys are hot.
Right, right.
They are tearing it up. And now people are starting to notice and they're starting to say, who are those guys? And let me tell you something, Brother B. They remind me of the team that Oakland had years ago. It wasn't big salaries, wasn't big names, but they were quietly getting it done. And the Orioles have been quietly getting it done. But guess what? Now people are starting to take notice. Hey, we got to play Baltimore. Hey, it's those guys that's got the second best record in the league. We got to look out for them. It's the hitting. It's the pitching. It's the fielding. Everything is coming together for them. You gotta like it. The fans in Baltimore should be loved. Baltimore is now becoming a baseball team again. I'm excited for them.
I can tell.
I never wear Baltimore colors.
I'm
gonna wear that orange and black. As a matter of fact, I will be in your town tomorrow.
Right.
And
right.
I will be sitting down in Camden Yards to watch those high flying O's
okay.
take all those bums from Cleveland, those Guardians.
Okay.
I can't wait to get down there. I'm telling you, Brother B, I'm just excited. I'm excited. Everybody should be excited about the O's because they are not the bum birds that they used to be. But let's talk about some bum birds. And you know what I'm about to talk about. Your team, those Baltimore Ravens.
Oh, Lord. Okay, now what?
Now, you know what, Brother B? They do some things that just, I'm trying to tell you, I every time I turn around, they battle me with some of the things they do.
Okay.
And here's a guy that they've signed as a backup quarterback, and he is a bum. And I mean, he's a bum. He's been in the league for 15 seasons.
Come on,
he's
Tony.
Been on, no, I'm talking about that bum, Josh Johnson.
Johnson.
Was a disgrace. He is not, this bum has been in the NFL. The
okay.
USFL, the XFL. He's been in the AAFL. This dude is a bum. He's been in the league for 15 seasons. He's been on 14 different teams. This is his third go-round with the Ravens. For some odd reason, the Ravens like having bums on their teams. That's why they're a bum team. And he fits right in with those bum birds from Baltimore. This guy's a bum. He does not even deserve to put on the NFL uniform, an XFL uniform, a USFL uniform, an AAFL uniform, a CFL uniform. He doesn't even deserve to put on a lingerie football league uniform.
Oh, Lord.
This guy is a bum, and you guys got him.
Not the lingerie league.
He fits right in with those bums down in Baltimore that wear their purple, gold, and black.
Not the lingerie football league guy.
He's a bum. He's just a bum, and you guys got him. And I'm happy because we had him, and he stunk up the field in Kansas. He stunk up. He just stunk up the field in Philadelphia last year. Listen, he stunk up the field up here in Philadelphia in an NFC Championship game last year. He's a bum, and you guys got him, and I'm happy for you.
Wow. Just tell her how you really feel, bro.
And here's one final note that 31 teams in the NFL are salivating right now because this guy couldn't even get traded away. He has a lot of talent, and I'm telling you, he made a statement that even though I don't think it's going to happen because he knows how much bum birds that those Ravens are, he said he would not mind playing with Lamar Jackson and in their offense. And I'm talking about DeAndre Hopkins, who was released by the Cardinals. They couldn't even trade him.
Yeah, that was one of the dumbest moves. I don't understand why they did that, but it was a dumb move. He's the only one that kept Kyler Murray above water half the time.
Yeah, a little big head midget.
Yeah.
So, you know what? I don't get it. I don't know what's going on out there in Arizona. They just hired that new coach who was a bum defensive coordinator up here for the Eagles. Brother B, that's all I got for you. Happy Memorial Day weekend to you. Peace.
Peace. Later, man. Well, there you have it. Always fun talking to the Petty. He was fired up today, and I ain't mad at him. Very, very happy to have him. So really quickly, I just want to tell you about Memorial Day for me. As a veteran, of course, it's special to me. I think the meaning is lost oftentimes because people celebrate having the day off as opposed to why we're really supposed to be having this day off. But for me, I understand completely why. I was in what's called the 3rd United States Infantry, the Old Guard, the Honor Guard of the Army. It's located in Fort Myer, Virginia, right outside of D.C., right across the bridge from D.C., next to Arlington National Cemetery. It is comprised of 1,200 hand-picked infantry soldiers, and there are a lot of requirements and specifications that you have to meet in order to be chosen, and there is a waiting list. And typically, because of that waiting list, they rotate you out after about 2 years of service in that unit. Well, I was one of the fortunate ones that they actually kept for almost a decade. And during that time, every Thursday in that unit, prior to Memorial Day weekend, every available soldier in the Old Guard would get up at the crack of dawn, 4:30, get into our formation in front of our company with our rucksacks on our back, and they would be filled with American stick flags. Once our individual rucksacks were filled with stick flags, we would all fan out to our pre-assigned section of Arlington National Cemetery. Once we got to a headstone, we would place the stick flag exactly one boot length away from the center of that headstone's base. And we did it with pride and precision. And we placed, make no mistake about it, we placed every one of these flags by hand. Now, I'm not sure if you've ever been to Arlington National Cemetery, but there are over 400,000 people buried in Arlington National Cemetery, veterans and dependents. And each one of them got a flag. And not only did we do it, but we did it with honor. We did it with pride and felt honored to be able to do this. We planted so many flags in such a short period of time that oftentimes we had to have something to cushion the palms of our hands because they were sore. But never once did I hear any soldier say the entire time that I was in the Old Guard that they did not want to do this. So it gave me a completely different perspective on Memorial Day than it did before I entered the Old Guard. And it's that we are celebrating those who have gone before us, who have given up their lives to fight for this country. It is not celebrating a day off of work. But I do want you to enjoy this day. A lot of people paid an ultimate price so that you can have this day. I just want you to remember why you have this day off. Enjoy it, but remember, people paid a price for you to have it. That's it. The last thing I'm going to leave you with is that often people have asked me to replay certain shows, and I've done that, and I've been happy to do it. But now you can listen to them at your leisure as often as you like on VoicesWired.com. That's my website, VoicesWired.com. Click on the Weekend Edition tab,
and you can listen to as many shows as you like. They're all archived there, and they're chronicled by date. So again, that's voiceswired.com. All right, so enjoy tomorrow. Do nothing, but like I always say, the best thing about doing nothing is you can quit whenever you want. So wake up Tuesday morning, go and conquer the world, and have a great week, people. I'm out of here. Peace.